Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Right. So rather than the kind of questions of like, well, what makes someone go travel to another country to fight in jihad and risk their lives? I sort of take the starting point of, well, it's actually not that surprising and analytically not even that interesting to ask why a certain number of Muslims, relatively small in the grand scheme of things, would feel compelled to help defend fellow Muslims in Bosnia.
This past week marks 20 years since the opening of the infamous detention center, Guantanamo Bay. It remains a symbol of the hollowness of the very values that underpin the liberal world order. Camp X-ray was to house dangerous jihadists, a nebulous general term that is used to describe those foreign fighters that would for no explicable reason travel to distant parts of the world to fight other people's wars. Within time, the term came to explain a universal ideology. From Bosnia to Afghanistan, Palestine to Kashmir, those that crossed national boundaries to fight for an oppressed ummah were lumped into a singular narrative, stripped of acceptable political motives and reduced of their humanity. Of course, sensible Muslim opinion may strongly disagree with some or many of those who participated and participate in this transnational jihad mobilization. The methods of ISIS, for example, remain reprehensible. However, the lack of intellectual rigor with which Western policymakers and think tanks discuss this phenomenon surprises us all. This is the argument of my guest today, Dr. Daru Lee. Dr. Lee is a practicing lawyer and anthropologist who has written a brilliant book on global jihad mobilization in Bosnia. His book, titled The Universal Enemy, Jihad, Empire and the Challenge of Solidarity, challenges the prevailing narrative and attempts to ask more searching and important questions in the process. Joining us with Dr. Lee is Professor Overmyr Unjum, who reflects on Dr. Lee's work and the broader themes that come from it. Dr. Unjum has begun one of the most exciting projects in the Muslim intellectual space today, bringing together academics and scholars to explore what he calls ummatic discourse and the need and requirement for a caliphate. As always, we have included a link to Dr. Lee's book and further reading in the show notes. Dr. Lee, Professor Unjum, thank you for joining me today. Now, Dr. Lee, I wanted to talk about your book, The Universal Enemy, Jihad, Empire and the Challenge of Solidarity. I know Dr. Unjum has many questions about your work, and he has on a number of occasions mentioned why your work is extremely important, and he's asked me and others to read your book. But I want you to set it up for our readers who may not be familiar with your central argument. What brought you to Bosnia? Why did you write this book? And what are the main issues that arise out of your work?
Thanks so much for having me on and for the opportunity to discuss these ideas. The motivating question or the motivating problem of this book, The Universal Enemy, is this phenomenon of, some call it transnational jihad, some call it global jihad, but essentially the conflicts in recent decades where Muslims have traveled to other countries to participate in armed conflict on behalf of the Ummah, broadly speaking. This is not all modern forms of jihad. And that's one thing that I think we can talk a little bit more about later, sort of what do we make of this category of jihad and what do we make of the category of jihadism. But I'm particularly interested in the transnational jihads because they have attracted so much notoriety. They're perceived, of course, as a security threat. They are kind of, you know, the primary target of the global war on terror. But they also excite all sorts of debate analytically, normatively, among Muslims and among non-Muslims as well. And I think it's because they combine certain ideas of Islamic piety, transnational mobility, and armed violence that they really disrupt kind of a baseline assumption that's shared by many non-Muslims and Muslims alike, which is that political violence really is only legitimate if it's carried out by nation states using armies that are composed primarily of the citizens of those states. And these jihad mobilizations don't fit that model, and therefore they are puzzling to some and scary to others. And the basic argument of the book is that rather than seeing these jihad mobilizations simply as a problem to be solved, whether it's a security problem or a problem in terms of how non-Muslims understand Muslims, the book proceeds from the hypothesis of, well, what is it that these jihads are supposed to be a solution to, right? How is it that they are thought of as a solution, which of course can be a flawed solution and one that can be critiqued? And the argument is that if we think of these jihad mobilizations as what I call universalist projects, it's a lot more helpful, and you can see a lot of things that you might not have otherwise, and you get out of the box of kind of the radicalization problem of, you know, how do we just think of these Muslims as security problems to be solved? So when I talk about them as universalist projects, I realize this is a little bit of a kind of anthropological argument. But what I'm really getting at is to say, look, if we look at a place like Bosnia-Herzegovina, and the war there in the 1990s, this was a conflict that attracted a lot of attention, sympathy, outrage from around the world in the 1990s. And it was best known as a site of Western-led international intervention, right? So you've got the largest ever UN peacekeeping force at the time, you've got all these NGOs. And at the same time, and what has been less appreciated, has been the range of activities by Muslims in the name of pan-Islamic solidarity that was happening at the same time. This includes aid work, this includes diplomacy, this includes education, but it also includes jihad. And what I noticed as someone who kind of spent the early part of their career in kind of the humanitarian and human rights NGO space is the parallels at work, right? In both cases, you have people traveling to this war zone in the name of a broader vision of humanity, and having to deal with concrete difficulties and challenges that arise when they are trying to help a local population that's experiencing violence and mass atrocity, and to overcome various forms of difference. So that's really the sort of initial starting point. But then in spinning out this idea of universalism, I want to be very clear that this is a sort of bottom-up anthropological idea of universalism. And what I mean is it's about people trying to actualize this vision that's directed at all of humanity. So of course, it's not actually universal, in fact. And of course, it also includes its own flaws and exclusions and contradictions. And also that it's an attempt carried out by people in the real world. And people in the real world might move between and engage in different universalist endeavors at the same time, right? So the argument is not that like Islam is a universalism and the West is a different universalism and they're kind of going up against each other, right? It's more about tracking the way that folks move between different ideas of universalism and, more importantly, different practices of universalism, right? So rather than the kind of questions of like, well, what makes someone go travel to another country to fight in jihad and risk their lives, I sort of take the starting point of, well, it's actually not that surprising and analytically not even that interesting to ask why a certain number of Muslims, relatively small in the grand scheme of things, would feel compelled to help defend fellow Muslims in Bosnia. I'm more interested in the challenges that they face. How do they reconcile this idea of commitment to the ummah with national differences, racial, linguistic, doctrinal differences? How do they practically face those challenges and negotiate them while at the same time doing so in a world order that is, of course, dominated by the West, right? Where there is not parity or equality. How do they encounter the UN peacekeepers? How are they treated in the global war on terror, and thinking about the sorts of overlaps and experiences that come with that?
And as I said at the start, you come to the subject as an anthropologist, and you've spoken about that briefly in your answer there. In many ways, are you critiquing the way many political scientists and those in security studies departments have handled the subject of transnational jihad thus far?
Yeah. This is a book about a jihad that is also a rejection of jihadism as a category and as an object of study. And so I think your listeners are probably pretty aware and pretty critical of a lot of the work that comes out of whether it's the academy or think tanks, you know, security studies, all of that stuff. Critiquing that work is important, but I also had to make a decision very early on that the book couldn't just be a critique. It also had to provide an alternative way of thinking about these movements, right? So I think it's very true that a lot of the writing on this topic is inflected by kind of anti-Muslim animus and by the imperatives of, you know, essentially Western imperialism. Like, I think that's, you know, I think that critique is very valid. But I also think it's important to have a way to intelligently study and talk about contemporary jihad practices and what people in the world are doing. And sometimes the critical account is so invested in critiquing the discourse that's anti-Muslim that essentially, at the end of it, what happens is the so-called terrorism expert, you know, can sort of nod and say, yeah, we acknowledge this critique, but we can just, you know, come up with a more refined version of what we're doing that will address this, and we will still essentially dominate the discourse about these people. So that's why the book is definitely a critique of this body of work, but also tries to go beyond critique and to really demonstrate that through serious and empirical and rigorous research, that you can come up with a better set of proposals. So the book is based on years of research, including ethnographic life history interviews with participants in the jihad in Bosnia, and also primary source archival materials, because the Arab Mujahideen in Bosnia, they were quasi-integrated into a state army. So there's an archival paper trail that we have there that we don't have, for example, with the jihads in Afghanistan or Chechnya. And, you know, it's based on you know, publications in Arabic and Bosnian, Urdu, French, Italian. Essentially, what I want to emphasize is that, you know, rejecting security state discourses about contemporary jihad practices doesn't absolve us from the responsibility to do real research and to get out there and figure out what was going on. Because in many ways, I think that is more, that's more devastating to what the so-called experts are doing, right? Because they fetishize, you know, research methods and empirical facts, even though, of course, you know, the quality of the research is often terrible. But, you know, I wanted to sort of demonstrate that, you know, it was possible to sort of, in that very specific way of empiricism, to play on that turf and to come up with something better.
We've now had over 20 years of the war on terror. Has the United States finally moved on, moved beyond this global jihad, transnational jihad mobilization? has it moved beyond Islam as the major threat? We now have a state actor, China, that is the major concern of American politicians and of course the academy, security studies departments, political scientists are now thinking and focusing on this new global threat. Do you get a feeling that the Americans have moved away from Islam and are now focused on China?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that I'm struggling with all the time, not only as someone who has devoted their career to opposing the war on terror, but also as a U.S. citizen of Chinese origin and kind of wondering which internment camp I'm going to end up in. I think it's a little bit of both. I think in some ways, what happened is that the war on terror was completely normalized, and I don't think that's changed. And in fact, one of the interesting things about the Trump years is how the escalation of the kind of globalized counterinsurgency violence around the world was largely ignored, because at least critics in the United States were so kind of caught up with what was happening on the domestic front. So on the one hand, yes, the war on terror has been completely mainstreamed. It fulfilled its purpose in terms of reorganizing the American state and its imperatives. And, you know, it for a time, it provided a kind of master narrative for organizing American political life. I think in that sense, it has been superseded, right? So it's kind of ideological organizing function, the thing that everyone kind of has to respond to and relate to. I think that part, I think that has been surpassed. And I think Trump in many ways, was the catalyst for that. What was interesting about the Muslim ban was the response, because it was the first time that opposing anti-Muslim violence became a partisan issue, essentially, in the United States. Up until that point, folks forget this, but during the George W. Bush administration, one of the few times that the Democrats were able to force Bush to change policy was in this situation where I think the management of some ports in New York was going to be taken over by a company based in Dubai, and the Democrats just went off and had this whole like essentially insane anti-Muslim campaign that forced the administration to change its policy. So it's quite and that was around 2006, 2007. To go from that to opposing the Muslim ban becoming a mainstream position in kind of the Democratic Party, I think that does signify a shift. Now, but that doesn't mean that somehow anti-Muslim violence is any less of a threat. I think it's what happened was that during the high point of the war on terror, anti-Muslim animus or anti-Muslim racism, and we can have a whole conversation about how to think about it as racism later, but that was in many ways the safety valve, right? The most politically acceptable way to channel the racist impulses and energies of a white supremacist regime and imperial state. Part of what Trump did was to essentially turn that spigot all the way to the left, right? And to give open expression to all of the other racial antagonisms that structure US society, especially anti-Blackness, right? So in a weird way, by normalizing and mainstreaming the public expression of all of these other forms of violence, I think a lot of the energy that was otherwise directed at Muslims has kind of gone elsewhere. So it doesn't mean that there's any less anti-Muslim racism or anti-Muslim animus. It's just that there's all of the other stuff that's kind of out there, and in many ways is much more connected to the basic structures of American society. So there's this weird way in which the war on terror is both over and not over at the same time. I don't know to what extent the ruling elites in the United States really have managed to reorganize themselves around the lines of confronting China in the way that they did with the war on terror. And I think that's also because the ruling elite in the US is also fractured so much, right? Like the response to COVID, of course, is just the final, you know, demonstration of just their inability to kind of get it together on certain types of issues, which of course is not really consolation either, right? It's just like a different kind of disaster.
It's now been over 10 years of the Arab Spring. Do you believe that transnational jihad mobilization is no longer viewed as a valid method by great numbers of Muslims. I'm thinking very much about the disaster of Syria and how ISIS took the mantle of this type of jihad mobilization and the problems associated with ISIS. Do you think that in many ways now, any good that may have come out of these transnational global mobilizations have now been lost with the failure, or at least what some would call the failure of the last 10 years of the Arab Spring?
That's a great question. I don't have a great answer to that. I think that the kinds of transnational jihad mobilizations that at least I'm interested in, you know, they're really a symptom of an international system that on the one hand claims to be able to enforce some idea of human rights and to resolve conflicts and to try to monopolize to itself the ability to have interventions, right? So the UN Security Council or NATO or what have you can say, okay, here's a war, we're gonna settle it by sending peacekeepers or doing something. And so there's a gap between that vision and the reality, right, whereby many populations, especially Muslim populations, end up facing all these mass atrocities. And then you have folks trying to organize an alternative or a supplement, right? I mean, that's essentially what the Bosnia story that my book writes about sort of tells. Whether that's over or not, it depends on a lot of factors, right? Like, you know, one would have expected, for example, there was a lot of disillusionment after the fall of Kabul, whereby the Afghan Mujahideen factions started turning on each other, and people who had supported the Afghan jihad, you know, suddenly said, well, what was the point of this? You know, we gave all this money, there were volunteers who went, and, you know, we thought we were establishing a sort of, you know, a proper Islamic state. And look what happened, right? So even in the Bosnia case, there was a lot of disillusionment that had to be argued against and argued through. So I imagine even now, you know, for every one person who points to, you know, what happened in Syria and Iraq as a sort of cautionary tale against jihad mobilization, there will be others who would argue otherwise, right? I mean, we do, for example, there are mobilizations happening, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, right? So that's where a lot of the security, you know, people are kind of paying attention to these days. So there's a lot of just local variation in terms of, you know, to what extent can people travel to certain areas? To what extent are certain areas or certain causes getting attention, right? And there's this interesting way where attention to crises and the distribution of outrage among Muslim communities is also kind of filtered through a kind of Western dominated media sphere, right? But also cuts against it in some ways, right? Like, it's been really interesting to see the general lack of response in the Arab world to what's happening in Xinjiang or East Turkestan, right? And a widespread distrust of some of the narratives about what's happening there, precisely because, you know, the United States is, you know, is so keen to emphasize them. So I wouldn't count out that type of mobilization. I think the potentiality is always there. And, you know, whether folks are in the position to realize those opportunities is a different matter. Whether there may or may not be states that will try to support it because it can be strategically helpful is another kind of contingent factor that's there. But I think what's important is that, you know, the potential is there, the idea is there, and anyone who does it, even if they have to reinvent the wheel in some senses, they can still draw on this history. They can still draw on the models and the tropes and benefit from or try to depart from the debates that preceded them. And I think that's something that, you know, that the book also tries to sort of, you know, get us a handle on, sort of understanding that and understanding its outlines.
Thank you. And Overmere, I would like to get your reflections on Dr. Lee's book, please.
Yeah, thank you very much for letting me join this conversation. I was very excited to learn about the book. I mean, the title, from the very title of the book, it was very clear that this isn't going to be just another book, because I think that the idea of universal is something that anthropologists just don't talk about. And it is not a popular thing to talk about. And to think of then jihad as a kind of a universal thing, one that's in somehow connected to universalism, I thought this was just a really brilliant framing. So there are many things in the book that I'd love to have Lee talk more about. But let me start with this central idea, universalism, and then jihad as not as terrorism, but as universalism. That's an idea that I get out of the book as something, an underlying concern that Lee has, that, hey, that we can take this jihad, which this war on terror discourse, and even before, has been so deeply associated with terrorism that effectively it's the lexical meaning of jihad is terrorism in the minds of many today, including many scholars. And let's provide this other category of enlightenment. You know, universalism is enlightenment. Universalism is reason. Universalism is what the truth is about. And let's speak of jihad in those other terms by looking at a very sort of anthropological phenomenon of what's happening in Bosnia. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so what's and this is why the anthropology angle is important. Anthropology as a discipline, you know, it's born from the colonial encounter, but it's also always been about criticizing universalism, right? So like you said, you know, some folks, when they hear universalism, they think enlightenment, they think reason, they think, you know, good stuff, you know, puppies and kittens and stuff. A lot of anthropologists, when they hear universalism, they think empire, they think capitalism, they think hypocrisy, right? And you know, what's I want to hold both of these imperatives together, right? So there's a couple of really common critiques of universalism, right? One is that, okay, you take ideas that are supposedly universal, but they really come from a particular place like the West, and then you try to impose them on everyone else, right? You've got, you know, the idea that, oh, universalist projects are hypocritical, right? You come in the name of human rights, you say maybe like, you know, the United States, you come in the name of human rights and democracy, but you actually are, you know, taking oil and so on. And that those critiques of universalism are absolutely valid. But they don't make something not universalist, right? Because again, when I talk about something as universalist as opposed to universal, it's not about like, oh, does this actually happen everywhere in the world or not? You can have five people who have a universalist idea and they maybe just haven't convinced other people about it. And that, you know, it may or may not be interesting to talk about them as doing universalism, right? But so many of the things, I mean, even like when we talk about, you know, in a field I'm more familiar with, think about human rights. So many parts of international human rights law started out because a small number of people, usually elites, lawyers, said, okay, this is a new human right. This applies to all of humanity. And even if, you know, you could take a poll of everyone on earth and they don't necessarily approve of it, it can still, through a certain set of processes, kind of take on that character, right, of speaking in the name of the universal, right? And that's the process that I'm kind of interested in. And that's a process that's always going to be contested and problematic, right? So when I talk about jihad, or this particular jihad, or these kinds of jihads as universalist, it's you know, it doesn't let them off the hook for critique, but it kind of sets up a different kind of critique, right? Because the typical approach, as you said, you know, is just dismissal. It's not even critique. It's like, oh, these guys are terrorists. These guys are crazy. End of story, right? And then, of course, among some Muslims or people who write in sympathy with Muslims, there's that defensiveness, right? So much of the writing on the war on terror that is critical also has a kind of like hesitation, like, how do we talk about these folks, right? Or reassurance that, like, well, of course they're terrible, of course they're terrorists, but, you know, just be a little bit more judicious in how you talk about Muslims or Islam or whatever. And, you know, I also wanted to avoid that kind of critique, because I think it's quite self-limiting as well. And to say, yeah, they're engaged in a universalist project. Universalist projects are often problematic. But that's okay. That's just that, but that moves the conversation to a different space. It's a different kind of debate than the sort of very, very kind of zero sum, highly charged kind of way that we are often talking about these things that then force us into a kind of defensiveness, right? And an inability to get at some of the harder questions.
Okay, so I guess let me press this question a little further with, I think in your comment on Talal Asad, you suggest that on the one hand, you find him very helpful. On the other hand, he doesn't move the needle when it comes to talking about jihad as a kind of terrorism. He raises many questions about it, but then leaves it there. Tell me about that. Tell me about how you experienced Talal Asad, and his critiques, which are very important and formative to me. And at the same time, I see some of the same limitations or silences. And then how do you think your book moves the needle?
Yeah, thanks so much for raising this. So for listeners who may not be aware, Talal Asad is a very, very influential anthropologist of Islam, also happens to be the son of Muhammad Asad. Talal Asad has had a number of really important contributions in the anthropology of Islam and also kind of the anthropology of secularism, right? And really encouraging people to treat secularism as something that can't be taken for granted and that also has to be critiqued as a form of power, right? And secularism, not just as, the not religious, but as a form of power that gets to decide what counts as religious and what doesn't count as religious and to enforce that boundary. So all of that work has been really, foundational for myself, for many other scholars. And so Asad also wrote this really interesting book. I think it came out in 2007 called On Suicide Bombing. And the book does a really excellent job of explaining why liberals are fascinated and horrified by the act of suicide bombing as a kind of methodology, and really, shows that the sort of exceptionalism and the obsession with suicide bombing is really a symptom of a lot of their own anxieties around the nature of politics and the nature of political sacrifice, right? And it's a really helpful and fantastic intervention. And I think, in many ways, the spirit of my work kind of is animated by the similar thing of like, if all these people are writing obsessively about a particular topic, you have to ask yourself, what is it that makes them so obsessed with the topic and to frame that topic in that way, right? I think that's a necessary first step before you can kind of come up with an alternative narrative of what that thing is. But the thing that the book doesn't do is, it's so invested in kind of pulling apart how, liberal Westerners, however we might define that category, how they think about suicide bombing, that it doesn't really tell us that much about the actual suicide bombers. And I don't think it pretends to, even though the title of the book is On Suicide Bombing. So again, we're back to the question of, rejecting the kind of dominant discourse or the security discourse is a starting point, but that can't be where we end up. Right, that by itself is it's just not enough, right? So, and then interestingly, there are a few times in his writings in passing where when Asad does talk about groups like Al-Qaeda and so on, he sort of says they're ruthless and they're violent and that's a sign of modernity and that's what they share with the states that fight them, right? And again, that is in some ways it's a very critical move, because it sort of challenges the moral superiority that, the US government or the West kind of take upon themselves. So in that sense, I appreciate where it's coming from. But analytically, it's not that helpful, right? Like, yes, it's true that Al-Qaeda is modern and is just as modern as the United States. This is what I meant earlier when I talked about critical arguments that are actually that are kind of self-limiting at the end of the day, right? So one of these arguments that you hear is like, well, these people are not medieval. They're actually really modern, which I think is both true and also not super interesting, right? Or should only be news if you have a very, very low baseline slash quasi-racist way of looking at things, right? So I think, the, you know, we have to be a little bit more, we have to keep advancing the argument, right? Not all critiques of the war on terror framework, I think, are equally insightful or equally helpful, especially if we're talking about 2021 versus 2010 versus 2005, right? So anyway, so Asad has said, you know, in passing, you know, okay, yeah, these groups are, you know, they're, he kind of situates them as modern and as temporally coeval with, say, the United States, and attributes the ruthlessness of their violence to a kind of political calculating rationality that the modern nation state has. So I don't disagree with that. I just think it's a very, very broad claim that doesn't help us understand the things that are different and that are particular to these groups, right? And, you know, anthropology in many ways is always about challenging claims that all humans do X by coming up with all of the examples, right? Or challenging claims that these particular humans are super duper unique by saying, well, actually there's like this shared thing that they do with everyone else, right? So it is a little bit of like a contrarian impulse in anthropology in that sense. But yeah, so, you know, where I depart from Asad is to say, yes, these groups are modern, but, you know, everyone is modern in a way. So where do we go from there? And the argument about universalism is one way of doing that, because the first half of the book, you know, really tells the story of these jihad fighters who came to Bosnia, shows all the different trajectories that they took and how they kind of related to each other. The second half of the book situates them in relationship to socialist non-alignment, to UN peacekeeping, and to the global war on terror, which are other universalist projects that are a lot bigger and more powerful than the jihad. And there, you know, on the one hand, by putting them together, that's, I hope, a productive move, because that's not what most readers are accustomed to. But then in comparing them, you can also start drawing out the differences again, right? Because as I mentioned, there's a huge imbalance in power and many other differences between these jihad mobilizations and, say, the war on terror or UN peacekeeping. And yeah, having a way of thinking about those differences without kind of totally, you know, otherizing these guys as, you know, backwards medieval, whatever, whatever, is, I think, a really important challenge. And that's, you know, that's not really Asad's project, right? And I also think, to be really fair, there's this question of who we should expect to tackle these issues, right? I feel that, you know, Islamic studies, anthropology of Islam, a lot of these fields have kind of been forced to talk about, you know, movements like Al-Qaeda or Islamic State in a way that is that kind of puts certain epistemic burdens on those fields that is not, you know, that's problematic and that's kind of unfair, right? And it's not to detract from the potential authority that scholars in those fields might have if they want to say something or to apply their skills to those debates. But I think there's also this question of, you know, to what extent should those fields be asked to bear the explanatory burden of talking about these groups, right? So again, I think it connects to this other question of to what extent is knowledge of and fidelity to various traditions of Islamic learning, you know, important, like, how do we talk about them in relation to these groups, right? Because one of the other critiques that's out there is, you know, like, they're not really good Muslims, or they misunderstand or they misinterpret, which I think is, you know, that line of argument gets us to a lot of weird places, right? And I think that's something else that, you know, folks have been sort of struggling with in how to navigate the pressures of kind of anti-Muslim expectations and audiences, while at the same time being true to the kind of diversity of opinions about all this stuff.
Right. Just to build on, I guess, the last comment, I did have a little more sort of a theoretical direction if you wanted to go in that. But before that, if you don't, as I understand, you don't talk about jihad in general. You talk about jihad in Bosnia. You don't talk about ISIS. And yet one could read and say, well, perhaps you're also talking about ISIS. So tell us about it, because one could say that what's happening in Bosnia is just so completely different from what ISIS is saying doctrinally, although in terms of the practices of practice of jihad, there may be some similarities. The fact that they are universal fighters, right, there is some similarity, that they are traveling to a place to support certain Muslims, that's common. But on the one hand, you find that among Bosnia, this katiba, there is a very clear sense of the limits and respect for the existing nation state, and almost you almost see a growth of recognition of people's culture and whatnot. And you have the exact opposite in the accounts that you read of ISIS there. But you don't make that comparison.
Yep, but it's a comparison that I want to set up. And even the fact that we're having this conversation, the way that you started to lay out the different variables in comparing the two cases, that is exactly the advance in the debate that I want to contribute to, right? Because so much of what's been written, you know, will either do things in strictly doctrinal terms, right? Like this category that I don't understand of Salafi jihadism. Like, I don't even know what, and we can talk about why that's misleading. You know, so we can either say, okay, well, the Salafis want this and the Ikhwanis want that. And that, you know, you're spelling out criteria for analyzing the different political logics of these jihads, right? And the other thing that you know, that your question doesn't do, which I appreciate, is it's not about more moderate versus more extreme interpretations, right? Which again is not a helpful way of comparing these different cases. So this gets to a larger point, which is that jihadism as a category is it's really problematic, right? So and the reason why it's problematic is not simply that, you know, it's anti-Muslim, whatever. It's that if you know, there's always debates among believers about what is jihad, and there always will be those debates. But jihadism, insofar as it's presented as a kind of secular social science category, ends up taking a side in those debates, right? And saying, okay, well, these jihads count for what we call jihadism, and we're going to build a category and write books and have conferences around that category. And the other things that other Muslims call jihad, we just don't care about that, which doesn't make a ton of sense to me. And, you know, I've talked about this in other places. So I feel like I'm a bit of a broken record on this, but I think it's a broken record song that more and more people need to hear, which is, again, it just doesn't, you know, there's like, you can talk about jihad practices in the world. You can talk about things that people call jihad, but to build that into a category of jihad in general, it doesn't work for me. Because, and it's not just, oh, there's violent kinds of jihad versus nonviolent. I think that's a bit of a red herring. I think it's even when we're talking about political violence that people call jihad, there's huge differences even within that, right? And that need to be evaluated through their political logics, in addition to taking seriously the traditions and the resources of the traditions that people are bringing to bear, right? So essentially, you've got folks coming in, you know, to varying degrees, reading fiqh or reading other sort of, you know, texts that we can call classical or what have you, but they're also operating in a contemporary world that's not really organized along those categories, and they're doing both of these things at the same time, and that I think is what is really important to sort of acknowledge and to keep in mind.
No, I think that you pointed in a very interesting direction. So the way I understood it is that, look, you have people using the word jihadism for violent action, whether it's, but it takes so many different forms, its justifications religiously may be different, and that it may be, even in the way that it's perceived by others, it may be seen as defensive or offensive, or it may be seen as, well, you know, this kind of jihad was pro-Western, this was anti-Western. There are all these other things. And even among Muslims, the justifications are varied and complex. And therefore, it shouldn't be a category about which generalizations could be made based on, you know, one case and then you go and expect the same features in everywhere else, or worse yet, make policy about anything that you label as jihadism based on your favorite case.
And so in terms of ISIS, part of it also is that when I finished the dissertation that the book is based on, it was just as the situation in Syria was heading to armed conflict. And I kind of had to make it was a bit of a fork in the road moment where I thought, okay, I'm going to either follow these events and incorporate them as kind of, you know, a major part of this study, or I'm just going to have to draw a line and produce the book that I need to produce and hope that, you know, at some point it can be brought into conversation with things that happen later. And I chose the second path because I realized that, and part of this has to do just with like the time frame of scholarly production, especially in anthropology, that if I was just constantly trying to chase the last update, that it would also produce the risk of a book that gets dated very easily. Right. So I sort of said, okay, obviously I'm very interested in what's happening in Syria. I do follow it, but it will not be a major part of this book. But that being said, you know, it is part of the broader category of transnational mobilizations, right? And so what's important about all of these cases is that, as I mentioned earlier, folks are defying the nation state system and its expectations. Right. Now, what I think is what's interesting about these two cases in particular is that Bosnia is one of the few times where transnational mujahids are working for a state that is recognized in the kind of international community. Right. I think the only other case that's like that in recent years is probably in the Yemeni war or civil war in 1994, where some veterans of Afghanistan came and fought on the side of Ali Abdullah Saleh. What's particular about ISIS, and the thing about ISIS that I've always found really interesting, is that it's kind of like a double secessionist movement, right? Like they're carving out parts of Iraq and parts of Syria, and the governing logics of those two different regimes always marked Dawla, right? And so they're doing this thing of it's not just like a sort of, you know, one of the crutches that we use in these debates is like, oh, these groups are against the nation state, they're just dissolving all borders into like kind of pure nothingness and it's nihilism, and you know, it's very kind of, it's kind of a cliche at this point. With Dawla, what's interesting is that, you know, they're really trying to build something on top of the existing institutional legacies of these two very different states. And that, I think, has inflected all sorts of things. Also, the extent to which, and again, there's been some writing about this, like how many of these guys are like ex-Ba'athists or whatever, which is, I think, another interesting question, but one that, you know, is kind of, I just don't have all the empirical data on it. I also think the influence and importance of people from outside the region in Dawla, I suspect it's been a bit overstated. Again, I don't really know. I haven't done the research myself, but I think it's a much more Iraqi and Syrian entity than folks tend to give it credit for. So that in that sense, it is, you know, you can kind of compare and contrast with, say, the Bosnia case, where you've got a small number of people who, you know, a small number of foreign volunteers in a much larger kind of like local Bosnian army, right? Here, you've got people coming in, you know, and, you know, fighting on behalf of an entity that's not recognized by the international community, but is also cobbling together pieces of two different recognized states, and still marked by the border between them in many ways. So that's just a very different set of dynamics. And even though, yes, there is a common kind of, you know, common base of, yeah, people crossing borders in a world composed of states. And that, I think, puts these two cases on one side and, say, other cases of contemporary jihad that exist primarily within a specific nation state on the other hand. So in that case, I'm thinking of, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, Taliban, arguably, or groups like, you know, the groups in the Algerian civil war or that were fighting in Egypt in the 1990s. But again, it's even just having this conversation is part of the advance I want to argue for in how we think about these things, right? Like we're comparing and contrasting these groups, and we're plotting them along different kinds of political logics alongside of the kind of relations that they might have with like doctrine or other sorts of other forms of Islamic knowledge. And that, yeah, again, we're not in the same zone as, you know, who's more extreme than the other, or who is, you know, who's a Salafi and who's a Sufi or whatever.
Exactly. And yeah, we have your book to thank for making this very clear. Absolutely.
Dara, I would like to take you back to an earlier point you made. Now, you talked about Salafi jihadism as a misleading notion. Can you please expand on this? Many political scientists argue that there is this conveyor belt to terrorism, and the Salafi creed and fiqh lends itself to this type of jihad mobilization. To what extent do you critique that type of logic?
Well, so I think the basic problem with that logic is you can't draw a straight line from religious doctrines to political outcomes, including violence. And anyone with elementary history, elementary knowledge of the history of Western colonialism should know that many of the violent forms of resistance in Muslim societies to European colonialism were led and organized by Sufis, right? So I don't think there's any inherent connection between these doctrinal positions and the outcomes. I think that, and this is sort of what I was saying about jihadism earlier. We all know, of course, that there's, and the experts, quote unquote, will concede that like most Salafis are, you know, not violent, right? Or not violent in the way that they care about. So for example, the problem with the Salafi jihadist category is actually just a narrower version of the Muslim and terrorism category, right? Which is that on the one hand, you recognize that not all people in this category, not all Muslims, not all Salafis are terrorists, but you still want to attribute the violence to the membership in that group. That doesn't make a ton of sense. Also, what happens when you define these groups, but then you've got other folks engaged in violence, but who don't fit your criteria, right? So you've got books that say, okay, Salafi jihadis are, they reject the nation state, right? And then you bring along someone like Abdullah Azzam, right? One of the most famous jihad theorists and practitioners of the 20th century, who identifies as Salafi, but who does not reject the nation state. Right. So then you just say, okay, well, I guess they're not Salafi jihadis. They're just Salafis who happen to do jihad. Right. So this is where the category kind of just breaks down logically. I mean, just putting aside, you know, the way that it's used politically to oppress people and so on, it doesn't make a ton of sense. And, you know, so again, this is where jihadism doesn't work for me. And putting a doctrinal label on it really is just, it's not just putting a Band-Aid on a wound. It's almost like creating a different wound on top of it. So it's, I think the fairest or the strongest version of this argument, of their argument, is something like, maybe under current historical conditions, we can correlate followers of Salafi doctrine with certain kinds of anti-state violence, right? And there are reasons you can think of for this, right? So for example, insofar as such movements need external support, you can say, okay, well, there are certain regimes that have resources and that are sympathetic to this way of thinking. So that can be a factor in favor, right? Or you could say, okay, insofar as following a particular creed or doctrinal position requires you or encourages you to kind of not follow a lot of expectations in the prevailing society that you're part of, And that might make it more possible for you to take certain kinds of risks, like engaging in political violence. Maybe there's a correlation there, right? But these are historically contingent and weak, I think, correlations, which is, again, you could say Sufis, right? Sufis have an ascetic tradition. An ascetic tradition can be helpful if you want to, become militarily active. And that was a correlation, and that was a resource that made it possible for many Sufis to lead jihads in the 19th century, right? But again, that's less about just Sufism as a thing, right? And more about understanding it in its context. And of course, the intellectual traditions are important, and we need to be attentive to those debates. But again, always kind of situating them. I mean, it's a really basic point at some level, but it needs to be reiterated because of just the tendency to say, okay, if you read certain texts, you know, then we have to put you on a watch list, right? Because that's really what that argument is about at the end of the day.
Right, Daryl. And I think that if we made this point every single day for the rest of our lives, I don't think it'll still get through, because there is a real deep tendency for us, you know, just as departments and schools within a department fight each other, Muslims themselves, like theologically, are interested in figuring out which theology is the best. And therefore, they are often alibis in providing these arguments to CIA or FBI or whatever. Right? So they're very interested in mapping these. So the Salafis are likely to say the Sufis are always sellouts, and the Sufis, if they see the winds blowing in that direction, they're likely to say the Salafis are always these terrorists, right? So this is very much inherently a Muslim problem, not merely security studies problem. In fact, I suspect these security studies people simply often pick this up from their informants and then turn those into institutions and in fact, strategies of war. But initially, I think that this is very much a tendency that is really religious sectarian polemics that become sublimated.
Yeah, that's a really great point. It's like the Khawarij are the original terrorists, right? Like, you know, Khawarij and terrorists, they're both just like terms that they're just labels that you use on the people you don't like. They don't necessarily have like, meaningful kind of content.
Can I ask, I mean, just to follow on from that, I mean, what has been going on here? Why is it that think tanks and academics have got it so wrong when they insist on this linear approach and they overemphasize the ideological merits of a particular group and they devise these labels of Salafi jihadism? And do you feel that it's just ignorance, or do you feel that the studies are being subverted for political ends?
This is one of the all of the above type situations. I think there is clearly a political incentive structure to certain kinds of arguments, right? Not necessarily that a person gets, you know, a written order from the state, but I think it's, you know, certain arguments are going to find a receptive audience more than others, right? The book that I've written does not have a very large market, right? And there are reasons for that. I think the point that Avamir just made about, you know, sort of intra-Muslim debates and the way that those are weaponized or amplified by state imperatives is also really important. But I also want to emphasize that, you know, the war on terror is not something that will be defeated by producing better books or better scholarship. Obviously, that's nice. That could be helpful. But there's just a need for just broader mobilization and organizing. And folks, you know, already know enough in terms of what they need to know to oppose the state, right? The real challenge is making sure that challenges to that kind of power are actually effective. Although to the extent that mobilizing is weakened by folks kind of reproducing some of these ideas and maybe, you know, turning against each other, this can be a helpful intervention, right? And that is one thing that I would like to sort of, you know, put out there, right? That, you know, there are certain moves of reassurance that happen in talking about jihadism and so on that I think are potentially problematic and should be revisited and reassessed.
I wanted to take this in a slightly different direction based on an earlier point that Daryl was making about universalism. But in fact, before I do that, another connection that was suggested by his earlier comment is, you know, whether Salafis and, say, folks who are more affiliated with movements such as the Muslim Brotherhood and its Islamism, as it's sometimes called more narrowly, conceived Islamism, that is, folks who have embraced the nation state, right? And he has an example of a fellow, a Sudanese activist slash diplomat slash, Islamist, Hassanein, as somebody who is in this circle in Bosnia and who is not there. In fact, he doesn't support the jihad of these people who are coming and traveling. So he's very supportive of Bosnians, but he doesn't think that this kind of crossing of nation state boundaries in order to support your brothers, that's the best way to do, perhaps, right? And then he is then used to sort of diffuse that situation later. Tell us more about that. So you have Islamism of a certain kind that in fact is reverential of these nation state boundaries and modern institutions.
Yeah, so this character, El-Fatih Hassanein, if you look at the secondary literature on the jihad in Bosnia, if you look at some of the ongoing propaganda put out by Serb and Croat nationalists about Bosnian Muslims slash Bosniaks being all, you know, Islamists and so on, this guy, Fatih Hassanein, is kind of a boogeyman. He's a recurring character. And the way that he's presented is, you know, he's, because he was very close to Bosnia's first president, Alija Izetbegović, right, who was kind of the national leader of kind of Bosnian Muslims slash Bosniaks. And so he's seen as kind of like, he represents a kind of pan-Islamic extremism that by extension infects Izetbegović and by extension infects Bosnian Muslims, right? So Serb and Croat nationalists are constantly trying to, you know, portray Bosnian Muslims as part of this global Islamic threat. Many Bosnians, you know, kind of, who are attuned to trying to win the sympathies of Europeans and Americans, you know, try to distance themselves from sort of pan-Islamism. And, you know, there's a whole other debate going on there. Anyway, so that's what Hassanein kind of stands for, right? He's the kind of like pan-Islamic boogeyman. He's Mr. Jihad. So what I found when I started looking into his life, and also he published a number of memoirs that are really interesting, is that he is someone who went to Yugoslavia during the socialist era, and was really kind of one of these students, Arab students, who went to Yugoslavia because it was a leader in the non-aligned movement. And he was from a kind of nationalist family. He has a brother called Sukarno Hassanein. His parents named him after the Indonesian leader who organized the 1955 Bandung Afro-Asian Conference. So he comes from that kind of anti-colonial background, but also was a kind of early Muslim Brotherhood supporter in the Sudan. I mean, it's in Sudan, it's kind of what we call the Muslim Brothers. It's a little complicated because there were different movements that came, but for the purposes of our discussion, we can broadly say he's kind of Ikhwanji, right? So he goes to Yugoslavia in the 50s, he studies medicine, he learns the language. He organizes Arab students who are, you know, broadly speaking, Islamist in orientation, and he becomes friends with Izetbegović, and later on becomes a kind of solidarity activist, working full time to support Bosnian independence and to support Izetbegović, mostly from Vienna, and has been accused of essentially arms trafficking and like smuggling weapons to Bosnia, because during the war, the UN imposed an arms embargo on ex-Yugoslavia that disadvantaged the Muslims, because Serbs, the Serb nationalists kind of inherited the old Yugoslav army, and the Croat nationalists had a coastline, so they could easily kind of smuggle in arms. But the Bosnians they didn't have access to weapons. So Hassanein was accused of being connected to the Saudis, to the Iranians, to bringing in weapons, doing all these things. How much of that is true? It's not really clear. But what is interesting is that, yeah, his relationship to the actual jihad fighters who went is strained at best. He doesn't show up in their fundraising lists. I've never interviewed someone who kind of, you know, thought of him as a person who was deeply involved. And he was pretty critical of this stuff. He wanted to support Bosnia. He wanted to support Bosnia in the name of Ummah. And he was not a pacifist, right? He was helping them get guns. But he just thought that, you know, having other Muslims, that what the Bosnian Muslims needed was support. They needed diplomatic support. They needed weapons. They needed money. They didn't need fighters, right? They had a larger army than the other side, right? They just didn't have the proper equipment. So he was pretty skeptical of these guys. And of course, what the literature on him that presents him as this kind of pan-Islamic, you know, boogeyman, what it doesn't acknowledge is that he's part of a Sufi order, right? So of course he has a kind of skepticism towards these Salafis, right? Even though this is also interesting, there were times when the Salafi Arabs fighting in Bosnia developed close relationships with Bosnian Sufis, right? Sometimes they felt that they had more in common with each other than with other Bosnian Muslims who were not even practicing. Other times they did have tensions and they did kind of get into disputes. But what the Hassanein case shows us is that pan-Islamism and pan-Islamic solidarity can take many different forms. No one owns it. No one has a monopoly on it, right? And so much of this literature kind of assumes that good Muslim activism is anchored within the nation state, and transnational Muslim activism or pan-Islamic solidarity is necessarily Salafi and is necessarily terroristic. And part of what the book really tries to do is to just decouple a lot of these things, right? And to show that, yes, there's variety. There's not just variety among Muslims, right? But there's also variety among pan-Islamisms, right? And that they're competing with each other. And Bosnia is a great example of that, because of course, Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia were all trying to present themselves as the saviors of Bosnia in very different ways, right? But even if we take it outside of the nation state framework, you know, what Hassanein represents is a certain kind of Ikhwan leaning solidarity with Bosnia. And what the Katiba represents is a more Salafi leaning variant of that. And, you know, they overlapped, but they were not the same thing. And as I mentioned in the book, after the war, the U.S. put a lot of pressure on the Bosnians to expel these fighters. And in particular, one of the leaders of the Katiba, Abu al-Ma'li, this Algerian, the U.S. threatened Bosnia. They threatened to cut off aid to Bosnia if he didn't leave the country. And Hassanein was the one who actually helped him get to Malaysia, because of his own contacts, right, with people in Turkey. Oh, I should mention that Hassanein is also a friend with Erdogan, right? So, he kind of helped Abu al-Ma'li get from Bosnia to Turkey and from Turkey to Malaysia, right? So we can think about the different kinds of networks and the different kinds of movements that are out there, but then the individuals involved can kind of move between them, right? And that's also why when we talk about universalisms, right, many different universalisms that speak in the name of Islam, many different universalisms that speak in the name of the West, and individuals as people can and do move between these different projects and these different orientations, even within, you know, their own lifetime or even within the same, you know, year.
Ofamir, I want to bring your Ummatics project in here. In many ways, you endorse a type of transnational Islam that motivates those who are the subject of today's discussion. I mean, to what extent do you feel that this global jihad has in a way harmed this form of Muslim political awareness and consolidated the power and legitimacy of the nation state? And where does your Ummatics project take the discussion beyond, I suppose, the intra-political Islamic debates about Islamic governance that have dominated Muslim discourse for many decades?
Yeah, thank you, Mohammed, for asking about that. So I had drawn Daryl's attention to the Umatics Colloquium, which is a gathering of intellectuals as scholars throughout the world who are interested in thinking beyond the nation state, thinking about the Muslim Ummah. And this includes people who are thinking, you know, thoughtfully and sympathetically and scholarly fashion like Daryl. And so the purpose is to get that conversation in the academic mainstream throughout the world. Now, personally, I may take a position that may not be one that I will settle on finally, or that's about Umatics. So on this question, for example, whether jihad helps or hurts Umatics, well, I think that really just depends. And then going back to Daryl's point, there isn't one jihad, right? Jihad is very much part of Islam. You can't really have Islam without effort, and jihad means effort. And sometimes effort just has to be collective and organized. And sometimes it means political violence as well. So I think that jihad itself in the 80s, for instance, like 80s is the quintessential era of, or the decade of jihad in Afghanistan. And it is, I think, in part the one thing that, and perhaps that also affects the situation in Bosnia, the context for Daryl's book, is really because it's right at the heels of 1980s. And you had this energy and cachet, religious cachet for jihad available at the end of that decade that then flows into Bosnia. But I don't think that jihad efforts and mujahideen, whether Salafis or others or Taliban, are really an exceptional action. In some ways, they keep the idea of the Ummah alive. They remind people of this solidarity that Muslims have historically had. And if you look at the fiqh manuals, one way to read them in the global era is that we are responsible for our brethren elsewhere. And if, you know, the fiqh manuals will tell you that if Muslims are attacked in one place and if they can't defend themselves, then the responsibility falls to those who are adjacent to them. And if they can't do it, then those beyond. And in a sense, you can really understand global jihad and the kinds of people who are flowing into Bosnia in that context very easily. You don't need to be a Salafi to do that, right? This is very straightforward. But on the other hand, there is this recognition of the political realities, which this fellow Hassanein seems to realize that, well, that's not the real problem. That's the real problem is that we live in nation states, and this is the real political issue, that these people don't have these resources, and that's what they need. But doing that would not have made Bosnia really viscerally felt, because it's only when you visit a place that you really realize what it means to be Muslim in a very different way and to support people across all these differences. So I think that this kind of jihad, moving people, when people move for one reason or another and supporting that, I think that does help. Now, of course, if you ask me about ISIS kind of jihad, I think that really has hurt Muslims and the idea of the Ummah, the idea of the caliphate. And it has hurt because I think of the moral choices that people have made. It's not because inherently what they're trying to do is evil, but they have chosen policies and to really commit acts that go against Islamic norms that are widely acknowledged. And to come up with justifications that almost go out of their way to justify violence. It's not that it's all impossible within any complex tradition to justify violence, but they have done stuff that I would say is truly bad, truly evil. And that hurts the prospects of transnational Muslim solidarity. But I don't think that it is a, you know, sort of a unique event that one should single out. Ultimately, if you look at the amount of violence that ISIS has engaged in just through the number of deaths, it's like something like the upper limit is like 30 to 40,000 people, whereas the nation state violence just by the Syrian nation state, what's happening is something along the millions. Right. So it's just the amount of nation state violence.
Just a quick question. Oh, I mean, sorry to interrupt. But to what extent do you think the decision to arrogate the authority of Khalifa, I mean, how would you situate that? Because that's a bit different from the sort of, that's connected to a solidarity claim, but it's not, a necessary part of it. So do you weigh that kind of differently in terms of the harms and so on that might be involved?
So if I understand your question, you're talking about, well, who has a right to declare a caliphate, that sort of thing, right?
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's part of the fundamental problem that ISIS has to face, that doctrinally Muslims have to declare a caliphate, or Muslims have to you represent Muslims. There has to be some kind of representation. And ISIS solved that problem by just excommunicating all Muslims who do not accept this, their representation. And that is where a lot of violence, I think, is justified. Not that they wouldn't have engaged in otherwise, but they justify it precisely because it's their doctrinal imperative. Whereas if you compare that to Taliban, for example, they never claim that they are caliphs. And when they are pressed on this issue, they're actually very realistic. They say, we are just an imara of that's our authority. We do not speak for the rest of the Muslims. So what they're doing, if you look at the traditional caliphate doctrine, Al-Juwayni in the 11th century says that if you do not have authority over other Muslims, then you can just be an amir who is upholding Islam, but you cannot be a caliph. Because to be a caliph means that the rest of the Muslims accept you. So what they do is that they excommunicate other Muslims by using various doctrinal tricks. But their need for doing that is really comes out of their need to make this really grandiose claim about the caliphate. That really is what makes ISIS exceptional, in my view. It's not just Al-Qaeda and Taliban and all of these other jihadist movements. You can critique them, and they need to be critiqued from an Islamic perspective, but ISIS does something that's the reason why all these other movements are in fact saying to ISIS that you guys have crossed these limits that should not be crossed. But anyway, I wanted to go back and talk a little bit more, or perhaps ask you, Daryl, about what kind of ummatic discourse do you think is one that is useful, and I know you come from the perspective of as an anthropologist, as a scholar, as an outsider looking in, but also, of course, as a citizen of the world, where you see, Muslim countries collapsing, and or Huntington would say bleeding borders, and then in fact he would even say bleeding innards of the Muslim world, and some kind of synthesis and reunification. I see that as really important discourse that has to be imposed not top down, but really supported socially, intellectually. What do you see that? What do you see as possibilities out there?
I think the point that you just made about authority and caliphate is an excellent example of how you can think of a bottom-up and potentially more open sense of belonging and solidarity and animation of some idea of the ummah, right? We're even that argument about authority, as I mentioned, this is already a much more advanced and a much more useful debate than how these things are often talked about. And it seems like one challenge is acknowledging the need for some kind of institutionalization to channel the energies and the sentiments that are out there without succumbing to the temptation to usurp or arrogate forms of authority where legitimacy has not been built up, right? I think one of the other lessons of the sort of Arab Spring decade is that spontaneity is politically useful at times, but also opens the door to co-optation and division and all sorts of other agendas. But then I don't know if the answer is, sort of pure Leninist, party state kind of, it might be in some contexts, but there's a question of, what is a healthy conversation around institutionalization? What does that look like? Right. And yeah, to go from, hey, we're some people in Iraq and some people in Syria who got some territory together to, hey, now we can order things upon all Muslims around the world is also, it's a sign of a certain, ungrounded politics, right? I don't just mean ungrounded in a very kind of like local legitimacy sense, but even in the sense of just, like the need to actually think about building relations of legitimacy that are horizontal and that are transnational. And that's really hard to do, right? And it is especially hard to do in the face of all of these challenges. But I think that's, I think orienting towards having those discussions is certainly, at least to me, that's more productive and that's more interesting than some of the other things that we've seen up to this point.
It's really been great to have you both on today. As always, I would like to take this opportunity to extend my thanks to my team, without whom I could not have made this project work. Riaz Hassan, Musab Muhammad, Reem Walid, Adil Alam, Yusra Zainuddin, Ahmed Siraj, Ahaz Artif, and Omar Abdussalam. These brothers and sisters have joined the project from around the world and give up their valuable time. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reward them for their sincerity. Please keep them in your du'as.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.